It's the Emily T. Gale Show, ESPNHawaii.com, and I'd like to welcome Dick Mudry, my longtime friend and a longtime sports writer, primarily golf, but welcome him to the show today. Hi, Dick.
Hello, Emily. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. Dick is speaking to us from Florida, and he's my go-to person for major golf events because he's covered them all. And he's got a long career in golf. And so we're going to talk golf and baseball today, not just the Masters coming up, but a lot about golf. But, Dick, would you start a little bit with your background? I think we've known each other for, it'll be 21 years now. We met at the what is now the Mitsubishi Electric Championship at Hualalai. It was the MasterCard Championship at the time. And had a long-time friendship and just – digressor meta here. I just went up and looked in my area of all the things you've sent me over the years, and I'm going to refer to some of those today, but I just have to thank you. I mean, I'm looking at a signed picture you sent me from the Masters with that Arnold signed, Arnold coming down the fairway. And so let's start on how you got, to be a friend of Arnold's, but starting back in high school, how it all evolved for you.
Actually, it started in college. I was playing golf at college, and we went up to Latrobe Country Club to play. And being from Western Pennsylvania, Arnold was the megastar, as was Roberto Clemente, the Pirates' late great right fielder. So anytime you got a chance to see Arnold, it was kind of special. And playing my match, and we ran across him off to the side of one of the holes at Latrobe with a cart full of clubs, as he was used to do for the rest of his whole life, and hitting balls, and he was very nice. And pretty much as anyone else who's ever met him would tell you, he was very kind and very cooperative and very helpful to the kids playing college golf. So it was kind of a neat to start there. And that evolved into covering Bay Hill when the Citrus Invitational moved from Rio Pinar in Orlando to Bay Hill many years ago, when I was working for a newspaper in Tampa. And when I moved to Golf Week for 10 years, I spent a lot more time with Arnold and got to know him and was very appreciative of the time he gave me all those years.
Well, let's go back to how you got to playing golf. You know, was it a junior golf in high school and the sports you played and how you became a not just a sports writer, but evolved into golf?
It basically started when I was young. I mean, I've got a picture. My mother has a picture that she gave me of me swinging a golf club at 2 years old. Caddied, like a lot of kids did then, way back then. Played when the caddies could play on, I think it was Mondays of the week at the golf little public golf course up in Pittsburgh, and evolved into that and played a little more and more, and eventually played my way onto the team in college. So that made it easy to know a little bit about the game and get into golf writing when I got into sports, in the sports business, when I moved to Florida in 1971.
Well, I think it's interesting, how people's careers evolve because, you covered every major out there and all the tours, some of them when they were just starting, like the Senior Tour, but you covered the PGA Tour and many of the players that are now on the Champions Tour. And that evolved into you being the writer of doing the copy for the Masters Annual, the beautiful coffee table book put out by Augusta National. At the Masters for like 10 years, and that you kind of were in that era when things were transitioning from analog, and you were filing your stories or putting them together into digital world. And so you did that for about 10 years, because I just went and looked at all the books you had sent me, those copies of the Masters Annual. Let's get right into maybe a little bit about the Masters and that experience that you had with that.
Well, as it has for so many people who are involved with golf, golf opens doors. It makes contacts. You meet a lot of people. You play a lot of golf with a lot of different people. And through the course of business, I came to become friends with Glenn Greenspan, who was the director of communications at the Augusta National Golf Club, home of the Masters. I had known Glenn for many years before when he was with the PGA Tour as a media official, and when he moved to Gary Player's organization, we still stayed in contact. And to this day, after he left Augusta, he's with Tiger, and I still stay in contact with him, but I kind of avoid discussing Tiger because that's basically a subject that I don't want to put him in a bad spot in. But we've remained friends, and that's how it happened. That's how I got invited to do the book for Augusta National, and when he was the director there.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the Masters. Of course, it's put on by Augusta National. It's a very non-commercial event. It is not a PGA-produced event, right?
That's
And
right.
let's talk about that. You know, the whole dynamics and organization of Augusta National and the Masters, maybe even how it started.
Well, Augusta National was the dream of Bob Jones and Clifford Roberts back in the mid-30s. Bobby Jones, after he retired from competitive golf, wanted a club for his friends to play at. It never came to his mind that this little tournament would evolve into what it has. It was called the Augusta Invitational initially, and it was a gathering of his friends there at what is now Augusta National Golf Club, and it evolved through the years. I mean, it became bigger and bigger and bigger and became a huge business as it is these days. Things have gotten so big that they have now have cabins on the grounds that more and more as the years go by, as they find more and more spaces for them. And it's the premier event of the US Tour.
I think I heard a number that you threw out last year about, you know, the reason, you know, there's no commercialism. They have very just a couple ads of some sort, probably from philanthropy or something during the CBS broadcast, but you know, no billboards, no sponsored, you know, announcements and things out on the golf course. And talk about that aspect of it.
Well, it's, you know, they wanted it to, Bob Jones wanted it to be pure golf. And the chairmen that have come along in the years since Bob passed away in the 70s, I believe, or late 60s maybe even, and Clifford Roberts have wanted it to be a pure golf tournament. You don't see any corporate signs, although there is heavy corporate involvement nowadays, but it is kept out of the golf course space per se. You would never know it's there unless you know it's there. And you have to have been around that situation to know where it's at. But they do entertain corporate clients. CBS has a bunch that comes in. Rolex, I think, comes in. There's several. Cadillac for many years was a sponsor, a corporate sponsor as well. But it's not that none of that is evident on the golf course. It's just golf and very, very reasonable prices for food or merchandise or anything like that. So it's become a bigger and bigger business as the age has moved from television to digital to worldwide communications, and it's just a normal growth, I guess, of a tournament that was very well run from start to finish.
I think you gave the figure last year of like $29 million that they make on the Masters. And the thing is that, you know, you've seen it go through a lot of these stages. And how do you feel about that? How they've handled it? And you know, it's everybody and every individually, we're all dealing with that, right? Evolving as everything evolves.
Well, business is business, isn't it? I mean, the Masters is more corporate now than it was in 1983, when I went to my first Masters, but then the world is more corporate than it is now. It was now than it was in 1983 as well. So I guess it's a natural growth. They do make huge amounts of money, which they never talk about, but the merchandise that they sell is in the millions, $20, $30 million just for the merchandise alone. And they give a lot back to the community and to junior golf as well with the drive, chip, and putt, and the tournaments that they handle around the amateur events they handle in South America and in Asia. So they do give a good amount of money back and do a lot of good for the growth of the game around the world.
And as someone covering it as a golf writer, when primarily it was writing in the early days, right? It was print media. and has that evolved into the radio and everything. So talk a little about the, how that has evolved and how you experienced those changes.
Well, it was print writing in those days because TV was still in its infancy, despite, you know, there were only three or four or five network stations. There weren't the cable stations. The Golf Channel didn't exist. ESPN didn't exist in all those many years ago, back in the ancient times. And now it's evolved because television is such an instant medium. It's developed into more of a TV show than a writing exercise. People don't want to read. They want news instantly. They want it on TV or they want it on their Twitter or any of that stuff. So it's changed dramatically. Basically, your CBS, which carries a feed, ESPN, the Golf Channel, have more of a role in the Masters these days than print people do.
And who would have guessed years ago, you know, the 24-hour golf news, always on Golf Channel, but other places too. It's just like, and of course, Arnold Palmer, one of the co-founders of the Golf Channel with his partner, Joe Gibbs. I always felt grateful to have spent time with both of them here at the Matalani Senior Skins. And it's just wonderful to see where the Golf Channel is going and has gone. And I'm looking at a photograph of a wonderful 8x10 that you sent me. And it's a picture of Sam Saunders, who I first met when he was about 4 years old, and meeting Arnold out of his plane when he came in for the Senior Skins. And he was Arnold and his son-in-law and daughter and Sam. And here he is caddying for Arnold in the Masters. And this beautiful picture you sent me, and Sam is handing Arnold his golf ball. But it tells the whole story of Sam Saunders, Arnold's grandson, who now plays on the PGA Tour, and Arnold, who will not be on that first tee for the ceremonial send-off of the players on the first day with Arnold or with Jack and Gary. So that share that whole scenario on the first tee.
Well, you know, since Arnold passed away last fall, Sam and Amy Saunders, his mother, as well as a bunch of other people, have kind of tried to keep things fresh in people's memories that Arnold was such a part of the game. Now, everybody who plays the game or who's been around the game knows that. But Sam has taken on a role of an honorary host at Bay Hill, which was a couple or 3 weeks ago here in Orlando. And he's grown up to be such a wonderful man, family man. He's got a couple kids and a wife, and he's moved back to Orlando to be around Bay Hill, I assume, to do more things with the club and the business end of the club. But he does want to have a career on the PGA Tour. So he and Arnold always had a special relationship. I think Sam is the only boy that Arnold had, as only grandson Arnold had. So it was, and he had a great affinity for the game. Played it in high school at Dr. Phillips High School, just down the road from Bay Hill. And Arnold, you know, Arnold wanted to help him develop into the best player he could be. And Arnold and I had conversations about Sam and his growth and his potential over the years, and you always saw a twinkle in Arnold's eye when he talked about Sam, and it was the easiest way to start a conversation with Arnold. Hey, how's Sam doing? And then Arnold was off, you know, and you really were interested to see how he was growing, how Sam was growing up, and how he grew up enough to be able to play the PGA Tour.
And yet Sam, you know, wanted some distance a little bit from everybody asking him, how is Arnold, right? He moved out to Colorado.
Yeah, you know,
I
think
love
by
how
Sam,
it's all evolved.
Sam being around Arnold and seeing how Arnold handled people and how good he was with people probably taught him more than Arnold could ever teach him by word. And Sam's grown up the exact same way. He has the same kind of patience with people. He's friendly. He, you know, he signs autographs, legible autographs, just like Arnold did. So I think the example that Arnold set and having Sam around to see it as he was growing up and older probably has made Sam, you know, more understanding of the role of a professional golfer or any tour player than a lot of people would, you know, expect to have.
And he sure displayed that when he did the eulogy for Arnold at the funeral. I always had followed Sam all through his, you know, web.com or the different places he's played, but that talk he did, that sharing of his feelings, and I think you might have told me he didn't use notes, but he's my favorite on the PGA Tour now, you know, just like Arnold was always my favorite, so it's pretty special to see. And the other thing about, you know, talking about TV, I think the great thing about what's happened is how much TV coverage there is. I was just looking here. I mean, I love that they show the par 3 event. Let's talk a little bit about that event and what it showcases, where the players play with their children. And then they've got a special coming up, three-night television event with Jack Nicklaus. I mean, and I love the different commentators they have coming in. And I see that Mark Rolfe from Hawaii here, who's been a great mentor to me, as you have been, is going to be broadcasting. So share on some of those leading into the, you know, Masters Week and the program.
Well, the par three contest has always been an interesting and a neat event on the Wednesday before the first round. There's a little par three golf course to the left of the 10th tee. It's Don set in a hollow with lakes all through the place. And it's just, you know, nothing more than a wedge or a nine iron in some cases, maybe less. But the people sit on the hillsides and they sit there in huge numbers, large numbers, and they enjoy it because it lets them be close enough to the players that they can see. The players interact with them. Players' kids get to play sometimes, certain shots, or on occasion. And it's a neat tune-up that nobody else has, nobody else has thought to be able to do in any other tour event I've ever seen.
Let's see, are the kids in little caddy uniforms? I forgot.
Yeah, they do. They're all suited up in the white and green with the green hats, and, you know, it's very prim and proper. It's still Augusta National.
Yeah.
But it does make for good pictures, too, with the little kids.
Yeah, it's such a wonderful tone leading into the week, and then of course the ceremonial first tee with Arnold, who did last year. Maybe he was just on the tee last year, but Jack and Gary, and the special with Jack will be great. I'm sure. I'm looking forward to it. I've been kind of out of touch with watching the golf and stuff, and I'm just trying to catch up here. But I see Michelle Wee is leading the tournament this week. But first, let's just chat a little bit about Dustin Johnson. My goodness, what he's been doing over the last few months.
Yeah, he's won three of the last five or six tournaments on the tour, including last week, the match play. Long hitter, everybody knows that. Not necessarily always a straight hitter, but Augusta National has always kind of presented a problem for him, despite the fact of his distance. And Augusta National, since five, six, 7 years ago, maybe 8 years ago now, they've lengthened it, which you would think would play into the hands of long hitters. And it does provide long hitters shorter irons to the greens, but if you can't putt, it doesn't matter. And Augusta National places such a high premium on position around the cup with your iron shots, and extreme test of your putting skills.
We're talking with Dick Mudry. He's a longtime friend and a longtime golf writer and other sports too, which we'll get into. But I just love that I was on the receiving end of the Augusta National coffee table book, and every year Dick would send it to me. He wrote the copy for that publication for 10 years. It was a big part of what was going on at Augusta during those years. And, of course, you covered it. How many Masters did you cover?
Somewhere 23, 24, something like that.
Wow. And, of course, you covered the LPGA. And just talking a little bit, watching Michelle Wee here playing well this week. And the Lotte will be coming to Hawaii next week, I think it is. And the LPGA, wow, just amazing. You know, what a global tour before the PGA Tour was a global tour, right? Although, when I was listening to the show last year, you had mentioned that Arnold and Jack had always tried to play internationally because they felt golf was an international sport, that they set the tone a long time ago for the PGA to get to where it is. But let's talk about the LPGA and how you covered it in the early days. And you sent me a story about Sandra Spork the other day from Detroit.
Yep.
And I was fortunate enough to play with some of those early LPGA players as an amateur on the LPGA. Talk about the evolution of the LPGA when you started covering it and what's happening today with it.
Well, I think the first LPGA event I covered was in the early 70s, like just after I moved here. We had the Orange Blossom Classic over in St. Petersburg, South St. Petersburg, and that's when Marlene Hagee and Mickey Wright and Kathy Whitworth and Sandra Post and Sandra Palmer, and, you know, those were the players of that era. Sandra Haney as well. So there were tons of them then, but that was a time when they really didn't have a commissioner. And they basically were setting Marilyn Smith. They always would set up the veteran players would set up the golf course, rope off the golf course, pull up the ropes when it was done, do some TV interviews. There weren't very many then, but also do all their media obligations. And, it was almost like a tour of ancient times back then, somewhat how the PGA Tour probably was in the late 50s. That was an evolutionary time, and as time has gone on, they've grown so much. They've got players from all over the world, and in essence are more of a world organization than anybody else, including the European Tour. So they've done very well with themselves. Purses still aren't probably enough to sustain most of the players that have their cards. And I don't know what you do about that. That's been an issue for 50 years, so nothing has changed there.
And not just in golf.
Just in golf, but in life. I mean, in life. So,
in life. It's all evolved a little bit since Title IX. My gosh, you made me, when you said the Orange Blossom in St. Petersburg, I played in that tournament as an amateur around 1967. It was a year I played you could play with a 5 handicap or less in LPGA events, and with Sandra Post and Janie Blaylock, we were all amateurs kind of playing a little amateur circuit that included a couple LPGA events. And I remember that event so well. I think there was a golf pro that spent a lot of time there that was at the men's golf course that only allowed men, Pine Valley or something. His name was Toby Lyons, I think.
Yeah, I remember Toby Lyons. Yeah.
Okay, all of that just came to my mind. The minute you said St. Petersburg, the Orange Blossom, I can probably remember the hamburger place that everybody went to. But what I do remember is everybody drove over to the spring training baseball games, I think, at that time.
Yeah, that's when the Mets were here and the Cardinals were in St. Pete as well. The Reds were in Tampa. The Pirates were in Bradenton then. The Orioles were in Sarasota. So there were, you know,
Tommy
there were
Johns
six...
was with the White Sox, right? Was he?
Right. White Sox were here for a few years, yeah.
One of the LPGA players had something going with him, and that was really interesting to hear you say that. And speaking of that, I have on, and let me take it off so I can read it, the wonderful pink hat you and Debbie, your wife, sent me when you were at spring training a few weeks ago, and it says, spring training with the classic Old English D for Detroit Tigers, and it says Lakeland, Florida. I love it. What a sweet gesture that was, but you spent, as you always do, a week or two at spring training this year. So let's talk a little bit about that. The Tigers.
Yeah, that was something we thought you would enjoy and something you would wear, so we figured that was a good little gift for you, a surprise gift. Tiger Time, that's the first time I've seen Tiger Time in Lakeland since they redid it. And they've done a wonderful job for the fans with the ballpark. I mean, the food and the variety of foods, the new scoreboard, the improved seating with all hard seats now instead of just bleacher backs. They've done a really good job over there. They spent a lot of money doing it, but it seems to have paid off.
So that would be the Illich organization, huh, that does that? And
well,
they've done
their... I think what happened is the city did it to keep the Tigers there.
Aha, okay.
Got that money through their, you know, taxes or whatever their
yeah.
budget allow.
I've been following it, but I didn't follow who was paying for it because I've been following a lot about what's been going into the almost billion-dollar project or more that Mike Illich, owner of the Detroit Tigers, Mike just passed away recently, also owner of Little Caesars, founder and owner of Little Caesars Pizza. I mean, he didn't come into a lot of money. He started with just one little pizza shop. I've always admired Mike Illich, going back to the early 70s. But, they've gotten a lot of good ink about that. You said Tiger tickets are very difficult to get. And Dick Mudry, longtime sports writer, but also a baseball fan, because you're from Pittsburgh, which is, to me, very similar to Detroit, Steel Town, and you're a big Pittsburgh fan.
Yep. Yeah, and Tiger tickets are hard because there's so many people from Michigan that come down here to winter or to vacation. The roads are nuts around here now, since spring training started. It's getting a little better because spring training's over. Most clubs have broken ground and are leaving for northern climates or northern games. But the attendance at Tiger Town is always good. Fans are always out. It's a lot. It's 90% Detroit fans, so I assume they're all from Michigan or used to live in Michigan and remain fans of the Tigers. But
or Ohio,
yeah,
because they have a farm team in Ohio now too.
Yeah, you know, and they've got a team down here in the Florida State League in the winter summer. But yeah, they've always been very rabid fans. All the clubs that come down here have fans, and it infuses a lot of money into the economy. They eat at restaurants. They, you know, have hotel rooms. They're down here for a week, 2 weeks. Some of them are down for the whole winter. So it's good for the economy. It's good for them. It gets them out of the cold for, you know, a couple months, and they get to see some baseball besides.
Well, you know, the Tigers play Boston April 7th, and interesting because the manager of Boston is Dave Dombrowski, who used to be with the Detroit Tigers. Mm-hmm. And so that's all of that is kind of an interesting a lot how it always, but I guess it does in every industry as people move around and go different places. And,
yeah, baseball seems to do that more than others too. They kind of recycle managers and general managers and rotate them among other franchises. So it's not unusual at all.
Well, they keep a lot of their buddies and friends and people they played with and people they know, right, within the loop
exactly.
of each one as you watch who's a manager here and who brings who where and yep. things like that. I mean, I love watching that because a lot of the players that end up back with the Tigers, not a lot of them, but just like watching Kurt Gibson do broadcast, you know, those are the people when I was really paying attention to the Tigers. It's a fun sport. They're all fun sports to watch and to follow. And I was just thinking about when we were talking about two things about the golf, looking at my notes, what I didn't touch on was how the Masters has changed and the aura around it and everything. I saw a story where Snoop Dogg is going to be giving a concert down just a couple miles from Augusta during the Masters. It's called the Augusta Jam. He's going to be at the Country Club Dance Hall and Saloon. So that tells you a little bit. I guess he and Tiger were friends.
The funny part of that whole town is that town exists for 1 week a year. You go down to that, you go to Augusta, Georgia on the Tuesday or Wednesday after the Masters, it's empty. I mean, it's a small town. There's not any industry there of any sorts. And they live and die on the Masters. They make the 90% of their money that week, whether it's renting houses to people or you're a restaurant or you're a hotel. And you know, the cost to go to the Masters is not cheap. Even if you can get a series badge, a season badge, it's not cheap because hotels double and sometimes triple their prices. Restaurants obviously jack up their menu, their menu items. So it's not cheap at all to go to the Masters.
Well, the something I saw about, I think it was Brando Chamblee, said last night about whether Tiger would be playing. You know, when you say everything focuses around 1 week, it's like in Augusta at the Masters, a lot of everything seems to focus around whether Tiger is going to play sometimes. That's not as prevalent, but I read something where he would still have his entry available to him then because he hasn't dropped out. Is that the thing?
Yeah, the Masters is different because past champions have until the Wednesday before the first round to enter or withdraw. So technically, he can wait till Wednesday sometime to make up his mind. My guess, given what I've heard and what I've talked to people, is you will not see Tiger Woods at the Masters. I don't think his back is ever going to be as good enough to be competitive, even anywhere near what he once was. I think
okay.
he's got a hard road ahead with back surgery and all the other surgeries he's had.
I figured you've talked to some people over the last few days that are a little bit, you know, on the inside. And no, I thought that was kind of curious, or if that's just a way to kind of keep that conversation going out there. But also, you know, we have some mutual friends in Art McCafferty from Michigan, golfer, and of course, he's a Michigan runner. Great supporter of the things I did in Detroit with the Emily Detroit runs and saying nice things about Detroit. And Terry Moore, who was the publisher of Michigan Runner, the editor. And then Jack Berry, longtime golf writer, who speaks highly of you. I guess you know, mutually respectful of one another in wonderful ways. And he wrote for about 50 years. I think he covered 100 majors over his career. But Michigan being a very, you know, per capita, a lot of golf played in Michigan. I'm always telling everybody in Hawaii that I work with the resorts, you ought to be marketing more in Michigan. You know, I can take your message there, which I do in many ways. But
sure.
Always was more golf played per capita year round, even though they only have about 4 months of really good, you know, golf weather. And there's a lot of LPGA players and PGA players that have come from Michigan. But they had a LPGA event there last year. I didn't have time to look and see if it was coming back this year, but the Buick Open was in Detroit for so many years. Was 2009, that stopped. 2008 was the PGA Championship. I happened to be in Detroit then and was able to go to the PGA Championship at Oakland Hills, which was a wonderful event. Parker McLaughlin from Hawaii had qualified to play in that. That was fun. But, you know, golf was just so prevalent in Michigan for so many years, and then with the auto industry having its challenges and it's coming back so strongly, what do you hear through the grapevine that you're so tapped into in regards to anything coming to Detroit? Because they'd have to have an opening in the PGA schedule, right?
Yeah, and PGA schedule, from what I understand, next year is going to undergo pretty extensive changes. There are going to be two or three events that are going to be disappearing, and they're going to be replaced by what I was told is one in Minnesota and one in the Ozarks, although the one in the Ozarks still seems to be kind of up in the air. What I understand, one in the Ozarks is what the Bass Pro Shops Cedar Lodge deal in Ridgedale, Missouri. I was told by a tour player today that the Legends of Golf is going away after this year. There will not be a Legends of Golf on the Champions Tour next year.
You know, last year I remember you speculated on that because you were, you know, around what the whole environment and the mood, and, you know, so sometimes it's really hard to keep that legacy of people really alive, right, as kids come up and, you know, different ages. And yeah.
And, you know, the Champions Tour started in Austin Country Club with the Legends way back in the late 70s. So, I mean, to have the inaugural Champions Tour event go away all of a sudden is unfortunate. But, you know, they're finding out that a lot of the guys that made up some of those, played in some of those early years, just can't play anymore or aren't physically able to play. So it's kind of hard. You know, you've got Jack and Trevino are in their mid to late 70s. Player's in his mid, I think he's 82 now. He'll be 83 this year sometime. Those are the people that draw names. You know, the kids now, just the kids, the younger Champions Tour players just don't have that pedigree to draw people like Arnold, Jack, Gary, you know, Trevino did. So it's hard
right.
to sell it.
And, well, you know, while they're, you know, since we're so fortunate to have the Mitsubishi Electric Championship here every year on the at Hualalai, we get to see, and I've watched it for 21 years now because I've been involved with the PGA Tour, Champions Tour, with that event, pretty closely involved. And you can see the difference from those first years when Arnold and Gary and everybody, I mean, there's a few of them, Hale, and that are still coming back, and the World Golf Hall of Fame players and everything, and the Jay Haases and Fred Funks, and they really do add a lot because they do have that spirit of knowing how important it is every day, all day, to keep promoting and play well as well. So I can see the changes. If you come on, you know, John Daly was there this year, but you know, regardless how much is written about him, it's still not the same sort of spark that some of those.
No, you know, I think what you've found or what we've found, discovered, is that the players that come off the regular tour now onto the Champions Tour have so much money and because they've lived under the umbrella of the PGA Tour's protectionism. And what I mean by that is they do not have to do or want to do anything. When they were playing their PGA Tour career days, they didn't have to. They didn't have to do interviews. They didn't have to go to pro-am parties like a lot of the older players on the Champions Tour did in those years. So they are less willing to commit in general to those kinds of things that shake hands and glad hands with sponsors and pro-am players to the degree that they did 5, 10, 15, 20 years ago. The tour wouldn't have succeeded without those players back then, whether it was a Ken Still or an Arnold Palmer or even a lesser-known name player.
Tony Lima, I like that name because David Lima lives here on the island, yeah.
Yeah, you know, any of those players who had not only name recognition, but they had good personalities to go with it, to go to those things and make friends for the tour. And people
I saw a figure that Dave Richards, do you know Dave Richards from Resort and Golf Marketing from Michigan?
Yes, I do.
I met him through Scott Head, who is the VP of Resort Operations here at Waikoloa Beach Resort, who I met through Jack Barry. Although Scott is from Hawaii and used to be at Wailea in Princeville, and then went to Michigan for 8 years with Rick Smith at Treetops, and he's back here, and he had introduced me to Dave Richards, and I sat and talked with Dave a couple of years ago for the Emily T. Gale Show here on ESPNHawaii.com, just like we're talking with Dick Mudry, longtime golf writer and sports enthusiast and sports writer, and I still love that accolade. 10 years, wrote the copy for the Augusta National Coffee Table book. Every time I share that book with someone, they're just like, wow. And their favorite one is the one of Phil Mickelson, the year he won and took that little tiny jump up in the air.
Yeah.
And that's the headline of the book. I love that one. But Dave, figured I saw him, and he had put out recently talking about an event, whatever, return to Michigan, that the kind of cost, like for the LPGA is $500,000 to about $750,000. For the PGA Tour, $5 to $6 million.
Yeah, that's about right. It generally runs minimum five, and sometimes it can go seven or eight, depending on what it is, what the event is.
Wow, that's
a lot of money to find, you know. When you're putting that much money into the purses, you've got to sell a lot of tickets and a lot of sponsorships.
Yeah, well, that's how sports marketing has evolved. I mean, I look back at the years when we were putting on our first Emily Detroit runs, and we couldn't get anybody. We did get some, but it was difficult because all the corporations wanted to put their money into football, baseball, hockey, because they could be in suites, they could take corporate clients, they could, for a run, you know, how are we going to engage in that and get all the perks that we hope to get from it? But I love watching how it's all evolved and feeling like I've been a part of it with my involvement with the Ironman and so many things like that. And you as well. That's why I love the backstory of your involvement as a writer. I think behind the scenes when we're watching sports is it's not just the athlete himself, but the behinds. And one that's coming to mind because I had it in my notes here is like Colton Wong, who's from Hilo here, playing with the Cardinals. He's struggling a little bit right now. Got a good contract last year, and now he's struggling. And what I see in his comments and stuff like this, he's just much more concerned about playing well than his contract. But I heard his father, who was his hitting coach, and his father runs a baseball, well, I don't know if you'd call it a calf. He's just been a mentor to many ball players. There's a handful that have gone on to major league and the minor leagues right now are just a wonderful mentor to players. And heard his father on a local show here, the Rosie Rosenthal Sports Show last week. And just listening to that and seeing how players evolve, too, and the backstory, the struggles, that everything isn't glamour. Every time you went to cover a major, it wasn't glamour, right? I mean,
More times than not, it's not. You know, it's hard work, no matter whether you're a player or whether you're somebody in the, you know, you've been around volunteers enough, and they don't even get anything out of it. They pay for their own uniforms on the golf tours and, you know, basically give their time free because they love the game, you know, so it's a hard job. The hours that you don't see are the ones that are extra long, whether you're on TV or print or radio, you know, running around doing interviews. You know, you've done it at Hualalai. So it's a lot of things that are never seen and never appreciated very much in a lot of cases.
But I always try to encourage people to really watch the whole production of all the different facets of an event that's going on, and how much there is to observe and just see what it takes, you know, for any size event to be put on. But watching it evolve, like even press, when I get my newsletters from Melanie Hauser from the Golf Writers Association of America, it's always, you know, often focused, particularly in the majors, on, you know, how far away is parking going to be from the press tent? Where's the press tent going to be? Are you actually going to have, you know, good facilities? What are always lobbying, right, to be treated better and just all of it.
Treated fairly, you know, in some cases you're just, it's, some of it is just awful. I mean, the PGA championships they've had in years up at Whistling Straits in Kohler, Wisconsin, which is in the middle of nowhere, they've been busing media for an hour. You get on a bus for an hour and you ride an hour north to go to Kohler because there's no hotels around Kohler. So, I mean, it's there are a lot of obstacles put in place. I worked 3 or 4 or 5 years in PR doing behind-the-scenes stuff at tournaments, doing PR, media consultant, and the things that go on and the fires that are put out on a daily basis are just unbelievable. I mean, it's silly things. Sometimes, like, you run out of water. We got to go get somebody to get water. You run out of parking spaces for some, in some instances.
Run out of carts. In the City's Electric Championship, they had a few more players, allowed a few more players in the Pro-Am. They handled it beautifully.
Yep.
But,
yep,
you know,
exactly.
That was just, you could tell, you know, watching Brendan Moynihan, the director of golf, everybody, you know, just really having to be right there when a cart, because you can't get out of sync with the tee times.
Yep.
And, oh, what did that lead me, when you just said that about things going on? Oh, I forgot something else that
like
came to my
drill.
Mind, but.
It's like a fire drill, basically. Everything is like a fire drill. Every day there are innumerable problems that you've got to solve, split-second, you know, decisions. So there's a lot that goes on that people don't know about.
Oh, I know what it was that came to my mind was I was fortunate the only two majors I'd covered of recent, attended and covered was at Oakland Hills in Detroit was the PGA Championship in 2008. And last year, the USGA Open. And, of course, the Oakland Hills, they do it right, right?
Yeah.
So everything was nice. You know, the press rooms, they're just so beautifully handled. But I pick that up a lot in the golf writers' newsletters is how they're advocating and explaining
to
everybody.
There are things that happened. The year Steve Jones won the Open, U.S. Open at Oakland Hills, the press tent was situated in an area where it was in a valley, just as a little thing. We had a hellacious thunderstorm one day. Rain came pouring down. They flooded the golf course. The press tent had water a foot deep in it. People were and this was with all the electric stuff that you had, the plugs on the ground, on the floor for your computers and everything. People were standing on chairs. They had to drain the – not only had they fixed the golf course so the players could finish playing, they had to suck the water out of the press tent for that day. So these are all kinds of things that go on all the time. There was a foot of water in the press tent.
I guess that explains why at the 2008 PGA Championship it was an absolutely beautiful facility with the floors and, you know, they were temporary floors and everything. That's interesting. So, well, Dick Mudry, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. I absolutely appreciate, I cannot believe all the wonderful things you've sent me over the years. One of them, I just, again, well, I look at it every day because the way I have it sitting in a container is all the golf towels you sent me last year from all the, must have been 100 towels in there from PGA Tour, all the majors. That was just really wonderful. And what led you to part with those?
Well, actually, they came from my brother who had that collection going on for years. I would bring them from wherever I came from and just send him a towel. You know, he just collected them, so he basically wanted to get rid of them. He was moving and figured somebody I knew would enjoy them, and you were it.
Well, I've added to it the many towels you sent me when you've been to individual tournaments as well, whether it's a hat or a towel or whatever. So I appreciate it. A big hug to you and to Debbie as well. And let's see, Tigers played Boston, and who does Pittsburgh play? Because, you know, once you never, you can leave Pittsburgh, but it's always in your heart, right? It's like Detroit's in my heart.
I think they open up at Boston on Monday or Tuesday, I thought.
Uh-huh.
But I could be wrong. I could be wrong. So.
Well, I'm getting ready to sign up for my MLB and dive into watching. I hadn't watched any games and stuff, and I've just been focused on some other things, but having a lot of fun with my my time between Hawaii and Detroit and the work that I'm doing between the two, and, you know, covering sports and trying to sell some real estate, which we're having, everybody's doing, you know, it's a good season right now and a good market everywhere, I guess, better than it's been.
Good.
And,
as long as you're enjoying yourself. That's the big key.
Pretty grateful. We're very grateful for your friendship, Dick Mudry, and we will be in touch.
I will talk to you soon. Aloha.
Always a pleasure to. I talk with Dick quite a bit anyway, but it's always a pleasure to kind of talk and share with our listeners some of the things we talk about. And he sends me stories all the time. He's become a real ambassador for Detroit, I think, in the way that he takes an interest in everything that's going on in my hometown of Detroit, that I love connecting Detroit and Hawaii in many, many ways. Particularly every week there's somebody coming through Hawaii from Detroit, somebody from my past or someone that I've made friends with, and I try to get together with them. And as we always say, they enjoy Hawaii, but they say nice things about Detroit while they're here, which is a movement I started back in 1979 in Detroit, and we're keeping it going in many heartfelt ways. And so thanks, everyone, for listening to the Emily T. Dale Show here on ESPNHawaii.com. You can also get the shows on Facebook, Emily T. Gale, iTunes Podcast, and Emily T. Gale Talk Story, or Emily T. Gale Show. Well, as happens every time I'm about to have a conversation with Dick Mudry for the Emily T. Gale Show, I do go through so many of the things he sent me, and I have them nicely packed in, not stored, but where I can look at them. But I go into them and actually touch them and look at photographs and look at the Master's Annual. And more than anything, it reminds me so much of the friendship and of having met Dick at the MasterCard Championship, now the Mitsubishi Electric Championship at Hualalai, and how much sports and being around just broadcasting, the friends I've made and what I've learned, just very touching. And we referenced a couple of people, Jack Berry, gosh, 50 years, he's sports writer with Detroit News and other new publications, but had the Lifetime Achievement Award down at the Masters. And Dick and I always joke that he got a parking space with his Lifetime Achievement Award, as Dick says, and a very good one. And Jack has been a longtime friend, used to run in my Emily Detroit runs, wrote stories about me, most of them good. I'd have to think if there were any that weren't. But anyway, just the friendship, and Jack has been a mentor in many ways. He's covered so many events, and Art McCafferty and Terry Moore. They were, gosh, they did everything to help us get going with our Emily Detroit runs. And then with Emily, the Michigan golfer, Art, did really nice interviews this summer when I was there for the U.S. Open, and we've stayed in touch. And I've just been really sentimental over the last 24 hours. So many nice things have happened. I got up this morning and had an avalanche of emails and messages from people. Shinola out of Detroit has rolled out their new watch. It's called the Gale. Of course, I've known about it for a couple of months because I've been working with their marketing team, and they've just been so wonderful and heartfelt and authentic in this tribute to me. And I say that I'm accepting it on behalf of everybody who ever gave us support over the years and continues to say nice things and do nice things in and about Detroit. And it's just really special. But one of the texts that I got this morning was longtime friend Pat Andrews and her husband Ron. They probably were more supportive of us during some tough times back in the 70s and 80s than anyone I know. And she had sent me a note saying that Ron, her husband, Ron Andrews, was going to be inducted into the High School Golf Coaches Hall of Fame, and would love you to be part of it. And of course, I won't be there. It's going to be in May, but Ron was, well, this is the note I sent back to them. Oh, Pat, that is such wonderful news. Darn, I won't be in Detroit. We'll be home May 29th through June 26th.
I'm so happy for Ron. You too. Just sitting here reflecting on a couple of lives so well lived, and I'm so grateful for having been on the receiving end for 60-plus years of friendship. Just occurred to me, Ron was my first coach and one of the very few in my life. Having been a pre-Title IX female jock, I didn't have many coaches. Ron made it okay for me to be a jock with his acceptance and encouragement. Sweet tears are now streaming down my face at this thought of Coach Andrews when I was a kid and in high school, and how much his encouragement meant to me and has continued from the two of you to this day. Just, you know, another example of people that when you stop and reflect, you know, where friendship has been and people that have given you support, it's everywhere. I feel it every day, all the time. Yeah, we all have challenges with some people, but the loving kindness that comes every day is pretty special. And I love doing this show on the Emily T. Gale show on ESPNHawaii.com. I am really grateful to have the opportunity to share my story, to share other people's story. I just love it. I love the interesting lives people live and how we can live interesting lives ourselves. So I'm a happy camper this morning, really grateful for a lot of things. Everything takes, as we always said, it's 1% glamour, 99% grunt. But when you just, you know, do the grunt and have fun with it and, you know, do the best job you can, I'm just find over and over again, it all comes back to us in the most lovely ways. So thanks, everyone, for listening to the Emily T. Gale Show here on ESPNHawaii.com. And I'm also on Facebook, Emily T. Gale Talk Story or Emily T. Gale. And at Twitter, at Emily T. Gale. And still on a steep learning curve with all the social media, but making a lot of good progress, I think. Just learning and self-teaching, and my gosh, I have to thank 808 Computers Robert for all his support in ways that he doesn't even realize, and also to some of my other supporters, Bike Works Beach and Sport, Jant and Granite, Higa Miller, longtime friends and supporters of the Emily T. Gale Show, Aloha Visitor Guides, Waikoloa Beach Resort, Keola Magazine. It's wonderful to have a lot of people in my corner. I really appreciate it. Well, I was just about to call my friend Chick Kunitaki and realized I didn't say thank you to the Kunitaki Ohana. And really wanted ever since I came to the island of Hawaii for my first Ironman in 1982, I think it was, or 81, and met Kunitaki family. They were our support team out on the highway in those days, but have remained longtime friends. So this is a special mahalo to Waiaha River Coffee, Chick, Dinah, the whole family, Jeannie, everybody, Helen. And the other thing that made me think of that is my starting to package up a Hawaii package to the marketing team at Shinola, then putting things in. And of course, everybody gets some Waiaha River coffee. That's always a hit when I send a package off to Detroit or anywhere around the country. So a special thanks again to everybody, the Kunitaki Ohana Waiaha River Coffee. And a special thanks again to Pacific Media Group for the opportunity to have the Emily T. Gale Show here on ESPNHawaii.com. Thanks, Josh, for your help. Aloha.